Herzlich willkommen bei Klinisch Relevant, deinem Wissenspartner für das Gesundheitswesen. Dreimal pro Woche, nämlich dienstags, donnerstags und samstags, versorgen wir dich mit unserem Podcast und bringen dir Fachwissen in deine klinische Praxis. Weitere Informationen und Angebote findest du auf unserer Webseite www.klinisch-relevant.de. Heute hörst du einen Podcast in englischer Sprache, der wie immer von Laura Reynolds gehostet wird. Could it be cancer? Medical Oncology mit Professor Hans-Georg Kopp. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Klinisch Relevant in English. I'm your host, Laura Reynolds, and today I'm welcoming back Professor Kopp to speak with me. You might recognize Professor Kopp from other episodes on Klinisch Relevant, namely an episode on molecular oncology and also immune therapy and CAR T therapy in the treatment of leukemia. If you haven't already heard these episodes, I can certainly recommend you go back and give them a listen. Professor Kopp is a departmental head of hematology, oncology and palliative care in the Robert Bosch Hospital in Stuttgart, and I'm very grateful to him for agreeing to come on and have a chat with me today. Today, I wanted to review the basics in oncology treatments, and update an overview of the current therapy options. The reason I wanted to chat to you about this is because the field of oncology is such a dynamic field, forever growing and changing. And I think if you're not working directly in it, you might get lost in what therapy options are available. And there's so much changing. Perhaps a specific cancer that was once untreatable due to newer therapies now is. And also with potentially less or maybe different side effects than the classic chemotherapy agents. And I think knowing the therapies has an impact on diagnosis also. What is the therapeutic consequence of performing certain diagnostics? And I think specifically about fields in medicine that do not necessarily have a daily contact with oncology treatments. For example, some surgical specialties, or indeed perhaps even internal medicine, but in a smaller hospital, who might admit a patient for a certain reason, but as part of their workup, end up diagnosing a cancer for the first time, perhaps on imaging, and you might be overwhelmed and think, oh my, metastatic cancer, there's no treatment. And on that note, if it's okay, I'd like to give two case examples. I'm working in geriatrics, where we're often the third or fourth or even fifth department that a person visits along their inpatient journey. And one case example I have is an older woman who was transferred to us with the first diagnosis of ascites and with the diagnosis secondary to chronic renal disease. She had not received an ascitic tap in her previous hospital. For me, I feel like an older person, they did actually have a history of cancer, and to have a first presentation of ascites, that just all didn't really add up. And it was curious to me why she hadn't had a diagnostic ascitic tap. It was later performed by us and there were cancer cells found. The second case is a patient who had back pain with sudden leg weakness, and on imaging, he had metastatic cancer to the vertebrae, which needed stabilization. And there was just a lot of delays in getting a histological sample to find out what his primary was. And in both of these cases, either a histological sample was not sought after, or there were just a lot of delays in getting one, thereby delaying any potential treatments. And it just raises the questions for me, like, why did it take so long to diagnose? Why did it take so long to get a histological sample? And I wondered if perhaps a lack of knowledge about the possible therapies out there might have played a role. So with what consequence would performing diagnostics and getting a histological sample have had in these patients? And I wondered if there is perhaps some ignorance in the medical field amongst us medical professionals who are not maybe up to date at what is possible now in the field of oncology. And I include myself in there because I find myself wondering also when I have patients and they have a diagnosis of a metastatic cancer and they're just taking oral therapy and it appears, you know, it's almost like a chronic disease that's being treated like beside all the rest of their other acute and chronic illnesses. So that was my motivation today to invite you here to discuss the current therapy options so that we might all go away from this and think, okay, it could be cancer, but also it could be treatable, even if it's a progressive case. So after that very long-winded introduction, I pass over the mic to you. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, if you'd like to give us a bit of an overview of what are the possible therapies that could be offered to a patient and what's the kind of the newer forms of therapy that maybe some people working in the oncology field won't be that familiar with.
Okay. So in principle, I think there are a few principles that we have to be aware of. First, cancer is a common disease. People in Germany carry a lifetime risk of 50% of getting diagnosed with cancer. And this already excludes non-melanoma skin cancers. So the most common kind of cancer is already excluded in this probability. So, and the second point is cancer in commonly is a diagnosis of older aged people. So most carcinomas, for example, have a median age at diagnosis that is around 65, 70. This is true for the most common types of cancer. So if you work in geriatrics, you have a very high probability of diagnosing cases with cancer. And the second thing I want you to be aware of is that cancer does not equal cancer. So malignant disease or malignant diseases can behave very differently depending on what kind of malignancy is there. So the most common kind of solid tumors are carcinomas, which have their origin in ectodermal tissue. So, for example, lung, colon, mucosa, prostate gland, or breast gland. So this makes up for about 90% of human malignant diseases. And then the rest is hematologic diseases, lymphoma, leukemia, and very rarely sarcoma, soft tissue or bone sarcoma. And the number three or the top three diseases in men and women are bowel carcinoma, colon cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, and prostate cancer. So if you know a little bit about these diseases, you will be able to be a good doctor with most of your patients, because in the two cases you presented, I think the most common cause of malignant ascites in women is ovarian cancer, but then of course it also happens in gastrointestinal disease, for example, gastric cancer or colon cancer. Those are by far the most common causes of malignant ascites. And maybe point number three is when you talk to patients that are or diagnosed with cancer or have a very probable diagnosis of being diagnosed with cancer, I think it's very important that you approach these patients normally. At least in Middle Europe, cancer is still tabooed. It's not something people are proud of. Here in the south of Germany, when people receive a diagnosis of heart disease, they're almost proud of. They come home and the neighbor would tap on their shoulders and, oh, you shouldn't work as much anymore. You did too much. You were always so industrious. When they come back home and tell their neighbors that they've been diagnosed with cancer, the reactions will be very different. People might stay away from them or leave them alone. It has, even the terminology malignant, or in German we say bösartig, which means evil, carries a lot of stigma with it. So I think the most important thing is that we talk about cancer as a normal, very common disease that can affect anybody. Many people are once the diagnosis of lung cancer is made, of course, you know, patients are aware of the fact that having smoked for the last 30 years might have been a potential risk factor. But at this point, it doesn't matter. At this point, you know, we also don't confront our patients that have been diagnosed with diabetes and tell them you shouldn't have eaten so much the last 30 years. We shouldn't. I think that doesn't help very much. So I think we should try to approach patients normally and then be aware of the fact that once you say the word cancer, the patient won't listen any longer. They will see their life movie passing by. They will think of dying, of maybe suffocating. Typically, when I tell patients about a first diagnosis of lung cancer, as soon as they start to have words for what they feel again, they will ask me, "Will I suffocate?" So this is very important because there is so much feeling of guilt and unspoken emotion. So that's very important. You should openly address what you think and what what you think the patient might be diagnosed with, and then always, if you don't know about therapeutic options, admit it. You know, don't confabulate and tell them, oh, this might be chemotherapy or even say aggressive chemotherapy and loss of hair and so on. Because even that is not correct. Even if the patient has to be treated with chemotherapy, they might not lose their hair because not each cytostatic drug causes alopecia. So, I wanted just to talk about this because in my experience or observation, many patients tell me that they really suffer from the fact that physicians or other people in general stay away from them, or they have the feeling of being untouchable or having a disease. The for example, their primary care physician doesn't know much about, and so they have a feeling their physicians are insecure in their counseling. So even if you are, I think the most important thing is that you tell them, well, you have a disease that the pathologist has a name for. I haven't heard about that before, I have to admit freely, but we'll find a specialist and then we'll tell you what can be done.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I feel like that's probably come from a lot of years of experience and wisdom. And I think that is very helpful because there's probably a lot of young doctors working out there, again, potentially in fields that don't deal like one-to-one with cancer patients, so to say. Maybe like a surgeon gets a patient with a different complaint, but in the workup, they end up kind of revealing they may have this cancer, and perhaps they don't know how to deal with that and how to share the knowledge or what's the next step. So I think that's really reassuring words you've just shared. So thank you so much.
So then generally, of course, a diagnosis of cancer is made very, very general. There is always, dealing with cancer or with oncology is always an interdisciplinary task. You always need several disciplines. You need surgeons, specialized surgeons in limited disease cases of solid tumors. You need medical oncologists or hematologists that are specialized in pharmacologic treatment. And then very often we also need radio oncologists for radiation therapy. And either one or two or three of these specialties will take care of the patient, and the patient will receive treatment. The field of medical therapy has evolved dynamically, as you mentioned. There's so many new substances, so many new approvals, both in the US and in Europe and in Asia, that it's almost impossible to stay on. You know, to really stay well informed about any kind of malignant disease, and that's why it's really, really important to have multidisciplinary conferences where we talk about individual patients, and it should not depend on which specialty the patient was sent to in the first place. That should never decide upon treatment. So this used to be the case until a few decades ago. You know, the primary care physician sent the patient, for example, to the surgeon, and the surgeon would do what he or she could, maybe even regardless of tumor stage. Of course, that's absolutely not good or sufficient. And on the other hand, you would always probably best be guided by an experienced oncologist who, you know, makes a diagnosis or has a hypothesis of what kind of tumor, what kind of cancer could the patient be diagnosed with, and then try to establish a diagnostic plan, and also in the end is able to interpret the results, and then, determine the stage of disease and care for a treatment plan together with, for example, surgeons and radiation oncologists.
And then in the field of the medical oncology, could you break down then what are the different therapies that are available?
Of course. Very, very generally speaking, there are three major groups of treatments. One is classical chemotherapy, cytostatic drugs that have been introduced the last 50, 60 years. For example, taxanes or anthracyclines or vinca alkaloids, stuff that you probably learned in medical school, that are either given alone or in combination and that are still the basis of treatment for many diseases, okay, classical chemotherapy. The second is, second and third have been developed roughly the last 20, 25 years. One of them is immunotherapy, which is typically in some way or the other always antibody-based treatment. So those are recombinant antibodies that are either recognizing certain target structures on cancer cells directly, so in order to directly mediate an immune response, or they are acting as so-called immune checkpoint inhibitors that are indirectly causing an immune response by activating T cells, cytotoxic T cells. These drugs are so common in the meantime and approved for most solid tumors and also for some hematologic diseases that an oncologist will use these form of antibody every day in the meantime. There are hundreds of thousands or millions of patients having received immune checkpoint inhibitors. And it's a type of treatment that's very important to know for any internist, indeed, for any physician, because the side effects can be so nonspecific. These drugs can cause any kind of autoimmunity, which can manifest itself as, for example, arthritis or hepatitis or pneumonitis or even myocarditis, anything that ends with itis. Okay, so in the meantime, especially rheumatologists, they probably take care of more cancer patients with side effects of immunotherapy than primary rheumatologic diseases. So this has become very widespread, very common, and any primary physician must be able to diagnose and discover or find, for example, the most common side effect, which is thyroiditis, or adrenalitis, which can manifest itself as Addison's disease. If you don't think of an Addison crisis in a patient that presents with hypotonia and may in some cases hyperkalemia, under treatment with immune checkpoint inhibitors, these patients might even die. Okay, although it's very easy to treat, you just have to substitute with a hydrocortisone or corticosteroids. So this was the second group, antibody-based, and the most important subgroup is so-called immune checkpoint inhibitors. And the third major group is so-called targeted treatments. Those are typically taken as tablets, and they have targets which are molecularly defined. Very often, molecular targets in a tumor that carries a certain genetic rearrangement. The model disease for this kind of treatment is chronic myelogenous leukemia, CML, which carries, maybe you remember, the Philadelphia chromosome, translocation 922, or BCR-ABL, and which is a tyrosine kinase that has an ATP binding pocket and drives the cancer, drives the leukemia. And imatinib was the first small molecule specifically designed to block this unique kind of tyrosine kinase in CML, and it does this very effectively. So ever since 25 years ago, was around 2000 or end of the 1990s when imatinib was approved for CML treatment. Ever since then, young medical oncologists or hematologists, they rarely see CML patients anymore because those patients are not admitted to the ward anymore. They rarely become resistant and very rarely need to be need a bone marrow or stem cell transplant because those tablet-based treatments are so effective that these patients lead a normal life. They have a normal life expectancy. So the model disease, the first disease where this targeted treatment has been introduced, has unfortunately is the one disease where it works best. But we use targeted treatments also in other diseases, for example, non-small cell lung cancer with certain recurrent genetic alterations that can be treated with molecular targeted therapies. And there's a long list of tyrosine kinase inhibitors that we can prescribe these patients and which have improved their prognosis and which can be also given to very safely to elderly patients, for example. So if an elderly person has, for example, newly diagnosed pleural effusion and is diagnosed with lung cancer, we very often had a very nihilistic approach before. In the meantime, the cells that you isolate from their pleural effusion can be genetically, analyzed. And when you find, for example, an EGFR mutation or an ALK fusion or ROS1 fusion and so on, there's a number of genetic recurrent alterations that we can find. These patients might be eligible for targeted treatments, which basically means swallowing a tablet or several tablets a day, and then going back to a normal life for at least another few years in many instances. So that really makes a huge difference, as opposed to, you know, dying from a progressing disease that is relentless and not treated. So I hope this gave a quick overview.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a really important take-home message, I would say, and the fact that these patients can live potentially for years with the newer treatments as a tablet. So I think for a take-home message, I would say, number one, think about cancer. I just remember in med school that I feel like we were taught it's cancer until proven otherwise. And no more than if you have chest pain, it is a heart attack until you have proven that otherwise. So for me, an older person, they just, as you said, they have quite a high chance of having cancer. So I feel like I'm always like, it's a cancer. It smells like cancer to me. So I feel like that's how I think. But I think it's probably no harm because you don't really want to be the doctor who misses cancer, right? So that's take home message number two. But number two is, even if you maybe do find a cancer, even if it's a metastatic disease, I think even amongst the medical field, I think we might also think, oh no, you know, it's, oh, that's, oh gosh, oh, they're gonna die, and oh no. But as you've just given a great example, they may have certain changes in their cancer cells, which make them eligible for certain treatments, which then turn their cancer more into a chronic illness than, yeah, that they will die acutely from. And I think that's a really important take-home message.
In many cases, if you diagnose an elderly patient with cancer, no matter what kind of cancer, patients are not aware of the fact that the prognosis might be better than being diagnosed with HFrEF.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
with cardiac insufficiency or cardiac failure. On the other hand, of course, I don't want to omit the fact that dealing with cancer patients really means dealing with deadly diseases and dealing with end-of-life questions. And the oncologist that ignores this fact might not be able to really very realistically talk about prognosis and might not help patients, even especially in cases where we do not have good treatments or where prognosis is not good, or where we, after a, you know, calculating the risk-benefit ratio of what we suggest, really is absolutely not in favor of treatment. And that's also, it's also a very important point. And I think, again, being very clear in these cases might be difficult, not only for the patients and their loved ones, but also for me, for my colleagues. But in the end, it will pay out for everybody.
Thank you so much. And there you have it. We've had an update there from Professor Kopp explaining to us some basic principles in the field of oncology and also where this very exciting and dynamic field has changed in the past years, what therapies are available to patients. So for take-home messages, think about cancer, think about getting a histological diagnosis, and then speak to your multidisciplinary team to see if there is a therapy available.
Vielen Dank, dass du heute wieder zugehört hast und unser Gast gewesen bist. Wir hoffen sehr, dass dir dieser Beitrag gefallen hat und du etwas für deinen klinischen Alltag mitnehmen konntest. Wenn dem so sein sollte, dann freuen wir uns sehr über eine positive Bewertung bei Apple Podcasts. Falls du Lust hast mitzumachen und es einen Themenbereich gibt, in dem du dich besonders gut auskennst, dann melde dich doch gerne unter kontakt@klinisch-relevant.de. Gleiches gilt, wenn du Themenvorschläge oder konstruktive Kritik für uns hast. An dieser Stelle auch der Hinweis auf unseren Newsletter, den du unter www.klinisch-relevant.de abonnieren kannst und der dich immer auf dem Laufenden hält. Wenn du dich für unseren Newsletter einträgst, bekommst du einen 5-Euro-Gutschein, mit dem du in unserer Fortbildungsakademie einkaufen kannst. Wir wünschen dir jetzt bis zum nächsten Mal eine gute Zeit und freuen uns, wenn du bald wieder einschaltest. Pass auf dich auf, bleib gesund, bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.